hello, Dr. Anna Cohen-Miller's class. We welcome you to Jyväskylä University in Finland. We will be starting shortly in approximately 2 minutes. So this is the Reclass Research Ethics Forum, and today's topic will be on social and digital media. So I'm going to hand you over to our moderator, Dr. Sigurd Dont.
Sigurd Dont.
Maybe we just turn down the lights a bit so everybody got a clear view of what's on the slides.
Okay,
doesn't make
that's
so much difference, but...
Yeah.
Okay, let me welcome you all to this third edition of the Reclass Research Ethics Forums, the last forum that we will have before the summer holiday. Let me briefly remind you, the Reclass Research Ethics Forum are a monthly event, usually on Wednesdays at lunchtime from 12 to 1:30 p.m. Today, you know, it's a kind of exception in that we're gathering on Monday, but usually we do come together on Wednesdays. Please note that these sessions are live streamed. And those of you watching at this, welcome all. Live streaming also means that there will be rolling comments before and after the event to allow people to participate from a distance and also to continue discussions after the event. However, live streaming also means that we will have to ask for your permission. First of all, we need permission to videotape your image for those present here. Secondly, it might be that we also would like to introduce comments in a later project, for example, a joint book publication we're working on. If you have any problem with this, if you don't want to be included on the video footage or if you don't want your comments to resurface later, please let us know. In that case, we will... Okay. Issues for discussion today. Which ethical issues are involved in doing research on social media or other interaction mediated by digital technology? Importantly, how do changes in EU legislation affect researchers working in this field? And possible issues would be, of course, issues of preserving anonymity and identity, but also broader than that, issues of ownership and voice when working with data co-produced by others, issues of commitment and positionality, etc. Today we have a presenter and a discussant with a wide and in-depth knowledge across areas of identity, digital spaces, semiotics, and superdiversity. So for that reason, I mean, today proves to be an interesting discussion. Just a brief reminder. Reclass Research Ethics Forums are not a traditional conference-style research presentation. They are meant to raise discussion as areas of common interest and concern arise. And for that reason, if you have a comment or question, please do not hesitate to intervene. Either raise your hand, and we have a traveling microphone. We will give you a microphone. You can also leave comments online. You can also make comments online, and in that... you can also make comments online, and then I, as a moderator, will pass them on to the discussant and the presenter. So let me now briefly present our discussants for today. First of all, as our first presenter, we have Sirpa Leppänen. She's a professor of English at the Department of Language and Communication Studies here at the University of Helsinki. Here at the University of Jyväskylä. With her research team, she has investigated the way in which resources provided by different languages, modalities, discourses are used in collaborative and participatory social media practices. More in particular, the role they play in identity work, belonging, participation, and political action. And more information about this you can find on the website www.socialmediadiscourses.fi. She uses a framework provided by social linguistics, discourse studies, ethnography, and cultural studies. And she published widely on semiotic diversity as a resource for social interaction and cultural practice in translocal social media, disidentifications and community online, and transgression as a means for cultural production, digital labor, and activism. Welcome, Sirpa. I'll briefly discuss Samu as well. Our second presenters are discussing for today is Samu Kytölä. His research interests include diversities and representations of minorities in football discourse and football cultures, the social linguistics of globalization inequalities, social linguistic diversity in Finland, ethnographies of digital writing, multi-semiotic digital discourses, social linguistics of style and stylization, and metapragmatics at large. For the past four years, he worked on a project funded by the Academy of Finland titled Language and Superdiversity Disidentification in Social Media, and his recent work appeared, for example, in Discourse, Context and Media, and also in the Routledge Handbook of Language and Superdiversity, which recently appeared. Okay, Samu, welcome you as well. Just one minor note for the next forum. Next reclass event, I mean, there will be a summer break after today, but we will be back in September with a session on more in which we continue discussion of EU regulations and the changes and how these affect us. Krista Varantola will be participating as well, and we still have to decide on a final date. So please mark your email, please mark your agenda and watch your email for the final date of this next reclass event. Okay, this was, as far as I'm concerned, the last of the household regulations. So this means basically, Sirpa, the floor is for you.
Thank you very much for the invitation. It's an honor to be able to talk about something that you think is very important. Just to get started, how many of you have or will be working on social media or digital media data? Okay, a few of you, right? All right, yes. So you know a little bit about the ethical issues already. So what I'm going to do is that I'm going to give you a fairly dense presentation of a lot of information concerning the ethical concerns, principles and measures in social media or more broadly digital media research. And at any point, if you have questions or comments, please feel free to interrupt me and ask questions. I understood that this is supposed to be a very dialogic event, but there are so many issues in particular in this area, so I wanted to provide you with a lot of information as well, as far as I've sort of managed to figure them out myself in my ongoing work. But that said, I think there are so many open questions and a whole lot of debate in this area as well, so some of the answers I give you to the challenges in the area are sort of preliminary, in progress in my own work as well. And I'm glad that Samu will be joining us later on as well, because he has had to struggle with the very same issues, and maybe he's going to shed light on the kinds of questions that he has had to face in his own work, at the practical level of work, whereas I'm going to talk on a more general level. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my background first of all. So I'm a sociolinguist, And I've done a whole lot of what I call discourse ethnographic work on particularly social media practice or discourse practice. And I started in the early 2000s when I got really interested in so-called fan fiction, which is informal, fictional rewritings of cult texts, TV, film, popular cultural discourses, and so on. And I got really interested in the ways in which young people appropriate cultural products by themselves. And it was a really interesting form of literacy as well. Very much emergent in the early 2000s. Mainly extensive texts, but also accompanied by a lot of discussion, debate, and all sorts of engagements, which also meant that this form of discourse was social in nature. And from the 2010s onwards, I've been looking at specifically multilingual and multimodal social media discourses. I've done some work on blogging and most recently got really interested on YouTube, transgressive YouTube performances. And these are some of the themes that I've been working on over the years: linguistic heterogeneity, identities and identifications, and disidentifications. We published a book in our project last year, actually. Sam was part of that book as well, which sort of... Oh, okay, right, good. Yeah, I've done some work on gender and resignification and recontextualization of popular culture, translocality, superdiversity, diversities of different kinds, and digital labor most recently. And over these years, I mean, I've been working on social media more than 10 years now. The awareness of the importance of research ethics has actually grown incredibly much during this time. I thought I'd give you a very quickly a definition of what I mean by social media, and this derives from the work that we've done together in our project. In principle, the important thing to remember is that social media is a very broad concept. It involves digital applications that build on the ideological and technological foundations of Web 2.0, which means that these are not only one-directional messages to recipients out there, but they involve a whole lot of interaction between participants, between author and their audiences, and the creation and sharing of user-generated content is in a key role in social media. Right, this content may be absolutely publicly available to everyone, or access to the data provided by participants in social media may be restricted to some extent in various means. And here are some examples of social media platforms, but actually the whole field of social media is a very diverse and varied one, just to give you some idea of the range of that variation. So all sorts of collaborative projects are out there, which might be called social media blogs and microblogs, content sharing communities, social networking sites. This is what people often think first when they try to think, I mean, about what social media means as a term. Social network sites, but actually social network sites is only one particular form of social media. Instant messaging, image boards, virtual game words, or gaming is also a forum for social interaction. It's a social medium. And virtual social worlds. So as you can see, we're dealing with something quite complex here. So social media is actually a range of different applications entailing different forms of engagement and communication. Right. Did I miss something? Yeah. This also means, if you think about the variety of different social media out there, this means that there's a whole lot of different types of content that gets created within the scope of social media. So content users create can involve comments, tweets, videos, blog posts, extensive text, short comments, and so on. And there's also data that records users' engagement with content and other users, like likes, shares, retweets, followers, friends, and so on. And the data can also include information about users that's collected, for instance, by a social media company, sometimes even without the awareness of the users themselves. So by data, by social media data, we can, again, mean a range of different things. And social media data may be used for different purposes as well. So as I'm a sociolinguist, and many of you are, you know, more or less doing linguistic analysis, this is already familiar to us, that observing and investigating social media users or the content they create is done for the purpose of gaining some information about their social, socio-technical, cultural, psychological, political, professional, economic, communicative, linguistic, and semiotic practice or phenomena. But social media data can also be collected for the purpose of developing and testing new tools. Right. Now, you've probably talked about the general data protection regulation already. No, you haven't? Of course. Well, I'm sure everyone's read about it and knows something about it already, right? Yes? Okay. Now, here's a key issue now in terms of social media data and the GDPR. Statute, and quite categorically, it could be formulated like this: social media users are defined as human participants if you are observing them or using their data for research purposes. So this is the general idea that's relevant to the analysis of social media data as well, as stipulated by this EU statute. Yes? Sari?
Or as participants in the social media?
Well, maybe we can come back to that, because I'm going to spell out existing
because there are so many fears and misinterpretations that this
Yes, right. Yes, I know. And those who have actually formulated the GDPR probably haven't thought about social media specifically when they've thought about the way in which their regulations have been verbalized. So there remains a whole lot of different issues there. And the important point at this stage already is that even though, you know, you have the statute, you have the legislation in Finland, you have the university guidelines, and you have the terms and conditions of the different platforms, you still have to do a lot of reasoning yourself as a researcher. Now, what is ethical practice? What is not ethical practice? And I'm going to illustrate this in a minute. So even though the GDPR may seem very categorical in the requirements it set to researchers, it leaves a lot of room for researchers to figure out their own ethical practice. That's an important thing to remember. But another key premise, nevertheless, as suggested by the GDPR, is that most social media data is defined as personally identifiable data. That's an important thing to remember again. And this personally identifiable data, in principle, it can be of two different types. So data allowing direct identification, name, photo, video, for example, data that can actually show who the participants actually are. But in social media, whatever you publish on social media can also yield indirect information about who the participants are. So, for instance, the IP address already is an indication of possibly who you are, where you are. It's traceable. It provides traceable information for others, which they can use to perhaps locate that person behind that IP address. Yes?
What about nicknames?
Nicknames, aliases, you mean? Yes. Well, we can talk about those as well, but yes, those are traceable, absolutely, in social media. And it may be possible to actually identify the actual person behind the alias. So I'm sure someone will be talking about the same thing later on. Yes. But what we usually done is that we've changed the aliases as well to make the task of, you know, tracing the actual users more difficult. But then also verbatim citations or quotations of what people actually post on social media can be providing indirectly identifiable data. And that's a thorny issue for anyone who wants to use social media as data. So, and it's particularly thorny for linguists and discourse studies people and communication scholars, for whom it matters a lot how their messages are verbalized. So this is really tricky. That's what I'm telling you, that, you know, that why it's so important to be very aware of the regulations and guidelines and still be able to do your own reasoning and argumentation. How is it possible to do research on this data despite these oftentimes very categorical guidelines and regulations? Yes?
Who are looking into taking the comments from these not dark web blog, but blogs that are, you know, very forums, and they're anonymous, like everybody is hidden in terms of who they are, and they're saying a lot of anti-immigration things. Yes. They want to take the comments and analyze the comments. Is that an issue?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, but I guess my response to that is that that scholars have the right to investigate problematic data as well, problematic issues as well. But we need to make sure that we do it as ethically as possible. So there's, in the name of freedom of research and science and scholarship, we shouldn't be, you know, too narrowly focused on, you know, is this ethical? In the superficial sense of not using problematic data, for instance, but we should think that it's our duty to engage with problematic and controversial issues as well, and that includes data. Yes, go ahead.
I have one question that so far I have had perhaps the false belief that if there is public information that can be remade public by researchers, but this is no longer true, since if it's in these cases it's mostly public because it's available there for, and so, and is it that those companies which make them public on the internet, they are not responsible, but we as researchers, if we reuse that data, we are responsible, so they don't have the responsibility. Mm-hmm. Or if I put something on the web by myself, then am I responsible, or am I only responsible as a researcher I go to study that for these issues? So is it not from now on no longer public materials are free to use in research? Is this what has come to you? We have come to now.
Well, public data is public data, but at the same...
How do you define public from this on?
Right, that's a good question. And that's one of the areas of debate in this particular field as well. I mean, how to define what is public and what is private? And there are no, again, I'm afraid, unfortunately, there are no categorical black and white answers to that question. Again, that's an issue that needs to be defined case by case and context by context. Under the umbrella of these multi-leveled regulations and conditions under which you're doing your research. I'm going to talk about that in a minute, so hold your horses. We'll get back to that question. Right. Yes, no, that's fine. Yeah. And I already said an ethical use of social media is a debated area, right? And some of these issues and questions and problems have already emerged, even though I haven't been talking more than 5 minutes. So, and again, an important point to be made at this point is that because social media is such a complex and evolving area, it's not possible or even desirable to provide strict rules regarding the ethical use of social media data. And things happen fast in this area, and things are very complex. And as I already said, this means that researchers need to assess the risks themselves and share their reasoned ethical principles and measures explicitly with research subjects, in the form of consent, for instance, and in their publications, whenever they talk about their work or publish their findings. So this is important then. At the same time, that said, there are a whole lot of organizations and networks that have actually published very helpful guidelines and frameworks which should help you in, you know, this kind of reasoning, in the explication of your own ethical premises and practices. And I've included some of them here. I guess I can share this with you later on if you want. And
please, yes.
Yeah, right. So first of all, there's the Association of Internet Researchers Instructions and Advice on Ethical Decision-Making and Internet Research. The latest version available online dates back to 2012, which means that it is a bit dated as a set of instructions at the moment, but I'm sure the association is already working on this in the light of GDPR. And there will be a revised set of advice and guidelines and instructions available soon. British Psychological Association has provided a very useful set of guidelines as well. And since this, they're concerned with the ethical reasoning in psychological research, a lot of their instructions focus on, you know, how to deal with research subjects, how to protect them from risk. So that particular set of guidelines is very useful if you're working with particularly vulnerable subjects. The Economic Social Research Council from the UK has its own set of guidelines as well, very useful. And then a very good source of information is a recently published book edited by Woodfield, The Ethics of Online Research. It's available electronically in our library. So it's a compilation of chapters focusing on different aspects of online research and ethics. And one of the papers mentioned here in my list is actually published in that book as well. This is also available online, so if you want to check it out, It's already there. So Townsend and Wallace's paper on social media research, a guide to ethics. I'm going to show you their framework in a minute, so you get to see how it's actually helpful. And then I discovered that University of Sheffield research ethics policy note series includes a recent addition on social media, which I thought was particularly helpful as well. And then Zevenberg and colleagues have published a book, Networked Systemic Ethics. I haven't had time to look at it yet, but one potentially good source as well. There's some literature emerging in Finnish as well. Unfortunately, not that much, and not that much that engages with the GDPR set of regulations. But at least there's a whole lot of literature already out there which can help you in practice when you're doing your own reasoning. Now, what should I do with my particular data? What about my subjects? What about the topic of this? Is it somehow sensitive and so on? So there's a whole lot of advice out there already. Now, this is the framework that's been suggested by Townsend and Wallace on how to go about reasoning your own ethical premises and measures. So this is actually a kind of a step-by-step set of phases through which you should go, through which you should proceed when you're thinking about the ethical issues involved in your data. So first of all, you start with the question, I mean, does your research involve social media data? If not, this framework is not useful for you. And the next important thing is to check the legal aspects of your work. So, first practical question, check out the terms and conditions of the specific platforms from which you're collecting your data. Have you read the small print carefully? You should. I mean, that's absolutely essential. The small print is absolutely crucial in our work on social media. There are surprising differences in the small print between different corporations. For instance, Twitch, as one platform, categorically denies the extraction of data from their platform. Whereas, for instance, Twitter is completely open. And Facebook data you can also use under certain conditions. So the small print matters. Yeah, it may be small. Petteri, you had a question. Sorry? Yes.
So it's a bit more difficult to gather
the data. Right, yes, indeed, yeah.
So since this is kind of a company-based regulations, and in some cases also in other areas, certain companies deny all information to be used as data. And do we have to follow? So if a company says that no information can, of whatever nature, which is in connect with this company, can never be used as data. Do we always have to follow that? So if they require the most secrecy or whatever, as such is public in a way, the materials is it that we still have to.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah,
so yes. So the company is producing internet content have the full rights.
Yes, if
regulate
they specify
their use.
Them as such in their terms and conditions, yes. So, for instance, I was discussing this very same issue with a doctoral student starting her studies, and she was really interested in Twitch, which is the video sharing platform, and she was despairing because she had just, after having this idea and developing it a little bit, read the small print and noticed that, no, she can't use this data. So what then? Tragic. Yes, someone.
Can I just add one? Right. Yes, I haven't done research on Twitch myself, but I have a few students who've done their BA or even MA thesis on Twitch material, and I, for one, didn't know about this thing. And I don't think we've been in the same seminar in the past 2 years, so I didn't even get the information from you, Sirpa. So, okay, and the practice is, or the recommendation here at Jyväskylä is that every BA thesis and MA thesis is also published freely online in the JYX, J-Y-X archive of the university library. Mm-hmm. And I've been very careful in my BA thesis and MA thesis to tell students that you should first, before you publish it, you can have your BA thesis, MA thesis accepted, no problem, but before you publish it in the JYX archive, you should be in contact with the librarian responsible for the copyright and such issues. Mm-hmm. And I think so far all the theses that use Twitch data, Twitch material as research data, have been published. And I think the same goes for a lot of stuff we've published and our students have published in the past, let's say, 10 or 15 years regarding online data. So how far retrospectively should we react to this, or should we react at all, is my question.
Right, that's a tricky issue. And I don't know the answer to that. Maybe we should consult lawyers on that point.
Consult the lawyers, yes, that's a very appealing alternative, but is it up to us as former supervisors or let's say supervisors of work done 5 years ago to actually go through and dig out all the possibilities?
No.
And I think I think like one solution might be like an ethnography. Because they might be telling you can't draw any data for your computer, you can't download any videos, but there's nobody telling you can't watch them, make your notes. Mm-hmm. But like, basically, if you don't gather the data, but you are doing an ethnography.
Exactly. Yes.
So I think that's like some gives a bit more space for the research.
Yeah, if you can paraphrase, that's sometimes the solution. Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Indeed, that's what I often do, and that's what I sometimes tell my students, BA and MA students, to do. But I think, as a discourse analyst and sociolinguist, that paraphrasing naturally occurring data actually destroys and completely wrecks the data, and also part of the analysis.
Yes,
I really appreciate ethnography and netnography as methods, but I think in our field of research, you actually need hard evidence, the actual discourse data, and that's getting more and more impossible to get and use via these new regulations and conditions.
Yeah, well, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a tricky issue for people like us, as I already said. But I'd say, I mean, as a word of advice at this point is that, again, the GDPR is not categorically denying the use of these kinds of data. You have to be very cautious in the way in which you use it. But they do have this concession to research, actually. But what I meant by, you know, my suggestion of consulting the lawyers is that the legislative text of GDPR is extremely complex. And how the wordings can be interpreted depends a lot on your legal knowledge of, you know, what these formulations actually entail. And at least in our university, the lawyers have not yet done this kind of work. In Helsinki, they have. And I hope that in our university, maybe during, you know, next autumn term, the lawyers will actually, you know, open things up for us. That's what I've heard a little bit, that the university is going to organize some sort of training for us. And we really need to hear from them. I mean, what does it mean when the law or the statute says this? Does it mean that I'm not allowed to do X and Y? So sometimes you as a researcher, I mean, you really need help now in terms of, you know, interpreting the legal aspect or legal content of this new statute. Yes.
General scale, I was just thinking that this is politically also very questionable, since now all the big companies can deny any research on them. So we lose all access to knowledge what's going on in their sites or their services. So if they put on the small print that any research on, let's say, Facebook, we don't allow any reuse or any information on Facebook to be used in research. From that moment on, there will be no civic or no investigation on Facebook legally available. They can sue anybody, and that will stop all kind of civic control or all kind of control of these companies, the big companies which are producing most of the content, the social media content and the services, which are... So in this way, we lose all kind of political meaning of our work.
Yeah, well,
as such, and all the controlling aspects.
But another way to look at it is, we, for the last, I don't know, 10 years? For the last 10 years, we've been lucky enough to have vast quantities of data that we can easily, readily get. Mm. Prior to social media and to digital technology, you had to go person to person and ask for informed consent.
Right.
So, and you had to do large surveys, and you just had to follow more. Unfortunately, the social media allowed us to grab a lot of data without really having to ask everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all that's changing, really, is that we have to be slower about it and not so lazy, or we have to make sure ensure that we're not trying to hurt people, which some people do with.
Yes, and we have to become very clever.
Yeah,
and read the small print of every single regulative discourse there is, you know, constraining the possibilities that we have. I'm not as pessimistic as Petteri. I think you can still investigate Facebook. Maybe someone knows what the small print is now like in detail, or maybe you do. But I haven't checked it out recently since I'm not working on Facebook. But in the past, it used to be possible to analyze Facebook posts in their verbatim form if you didn't, post them in the interface as it shows in the interface of Facebook itself. So you extract the data out of there, but you don't show the actual Facebook environment, right? So there are all sorts. That's what I mean. I mean, you have to be very clever and read the legal text and regulations very carefully. I mean, what is my opportunity here? But yes, go ahead.
My point would be that, yes, we need to consult lawyers, but on the other hand, we as researchers need to do our job as well.
Of course,
the lawyers don't know the contents or the aims of our work and research. And what I've come across in ethical committee is usually that we researchers, we need to know and where to go. And that's why the guidelines are for. Mm-hmm. And I wouldn't be also that pessimistic. It's also something that I would like to say that GDPR is mostly done because of commercial reasons and because people's identities have been misused for commercial reasons. Mm. And it's quite vague and it's quite complex, as you said. Yep. There's a lot of space for interpretation when dealing with research.
Indeed.
And this is the time when we are still... We don't have a legislation in Finland yet. We have it should be passed by today or tomorrow, but nobody knows.
Yeah.
But
the proposal that the
proposal
government
is yeah,
has
but
made
the,
is due
yeah,
in
but
September.
It's mostly about not so much about research, and that's why researchers need to pay attention to with lawyers, of course, not only because of lawyers.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. I agree completely. That was a very good comment. Right. Yes.
And also, I think we need a bit of anarchy because we can't really do anything at the moment if we like really go on the strict rules. Like basically we need to apply them and be sure like we are able to do these things ethically.
Yes.
And one issue I think it's also like you were talking about, like companies have their social media accounts and we can't use them. So I think the biggest question now is who owns the data? Is it Facebook's data? Is it the company's data? Is it public data? Mm-hmm. So basically whose is it? So I don't think this is like quite clear at the moment. So are they able to deny it if the Facebook terms say something else, or is it public or semi-public? You need to be able to be a member of the Facebook to go and actually dig more of the data. So I think it's called semi-public data. But any case, like these are a bit open at the moment, I think.
Yeah, indeed.
Well, what they say here, not about groups, but about your own personal profile
fields or life events, about your religious views, political views, who you are interested in, or your health, this and other information such as racial, ethnic origin, philosophical beliefs, or trade union membership is subject to special protection under EU law. That means the personal data on there, but going into a group and a group comment, that's a different thing. That's not what they're stating. They're only stating your personal profile.
And it's sensitive data.
Right.
There are different things.
I have a very simple question because I'm only fresh, very fresh with this and only starting to do something with the report. It's not this complex as using Facebook or anything. But I'd like to, for a report, use web data from a web page that has been published by the city of Helsinki. And of course, I need to protect the people who have their comments there, some of them by their names, which I'm definitely not going to use. There's no point in that. Most of those are anonymous. And some are somehow, I would say, language politically sensitive, but not very sensitive individually. So who owns the page? Is it the city of Helsinki who has the platform, offered the platform and collected those things and put them open online for me to do research on? So do I have to ask the city of Helsinki? Because, of course, I can't have any contact with the people, most of whom are anonymous.
Well, I think the really important question to ask at that stage is not so much who owns the data, but is it publicly available or not? And to me, that seems that that is publicly available. It's not restricted in any way. It's public in the very same way as, for instance, newspaper discourse is public. So I don't think you need to ask for their permission.
That's what I thought initially, but after this discussion,
No need to panic. But if you don't mind, I would like to proceed a little bit more further and then we can have another session for discussion because, some of the questions already relate to what's sort of coming up in this presentation. So we talked about the terms and conditions of the platforms themselves as an important source of information for you in order to reason your ethical guidelines yourself. And then, of course, you should consult the disciplinary, funding, legal and institutional guidelines available to you and relevant to your work. And then there are all sorts of questions relating to privacy and risk, which we already discussed to some extent. So one thing that you should think about, relating to Christina's question just now, that can the social media user reasonably expect to be observed by strangers? And the Helsinki City page absolutely builds on this idea that it's accessible to everyone. So it's public. But then again, Facebook posts, for instance, if your Facebook profile is not a public one, then you need to get permission from the users themselves to use their data, because the access to this data is regulated by the users themselves. So this data would not be public, not publicly accessible, not usable by researchers as such without permission or consent, right? And then you need to think about, are the research participants somehow vulnerable? Even when you're dealing with public data, publicly available data, you need to think about, are they somehow vulnerable? Are they minors? Are they in some other way vulnerable? Then you need to think about now, even with public data again, is the subject matter sensitive? And that goes back to the question about, you know, can we, should we, shouldn't we investigate controversial, problematic material? You need to sort out those ethical issues as well. So this is something to think about. And then when you publish your work on social media data, you need to think about, if you do not have explicit consent from the participants themselves, which give you permission to cite them explicitly or use their real names or real aliases, you need to think, should I anonymize my data when I publish it as much as humanly possible? And then finally, you need to think about, can you publish or share the data set? And especially in the light of GDPR, this is a problematic point, as we have already discussed, that, you know, can you publish, republish verbatim pieces of data? Right. So a whole lot of questions for you to think about and reason your own ethical principles and measures. And I'm just going to give you an example. I'm not going to discuss this, that maybe you can go back to this article yourselves later on. If there's time, we can look at them in more detail. But the paper by Townsend and Wallace also includes a number of cases, very useful in the sense that they show how the researchers themselves have done their own reasoning using this framework and come up with solutions that ensure that their research on these particular sets of data is ethical. Just very quickly, here's an example where the researcher wants to investigate members of a discussion forum and the support mechanisms they are using, and the researcher is aware that this data is private. So this raises the questions about the ethics of accessing the data and how to report the findings. So this is the ethical dilemma here. And then they give the solution. And notice how it builds on a very careful articulation of, now this is ethical because. It's not referring directly to the GDPR or Finnish law or whatever. It certainly takes them into account, but then spells out in very explicit terms, this is what I do, and this is how it's ethical under these circumstances. This is a very good example, and there are, I think, three or four other cases that they discuss. Extremely useful. Read them. Okay. And a few more points, and then I'll give the floor to Samu in a minute. And we can discuss a little bit more. So, legality. We talked about the terms and conditions already, and we've referred to GDPR a few times. And this is, again, a ground rule here. Identifiable and potentially identifiable data is subject to regulations set out in the GDPR. And an appropriate legal basis for the processing of personal data must be identified. In terms of research, this means research, quite simply. That's the legal basis for processing, investigating data, social media data. And the problem, again, which has already surfaced several times now, is that social media data is still potentially identifiable even if usernames have been removed, even though the data has been anonymized by removing the real names or the alias names. So this is one of the dilemmas that we have to deal with constantly in social media research. Okay, I won't go into this. What to remember about the GDPR, what it actually regulates. Maybe the most important point here is that it states that we must gain consent from the data subject, which must be freely given, specific, informed, and unambiguous. This is the categorical rule in GDPR. But you have to remember that this concerns data which is not public. You can still use public data without consent, as Christina's question in a way highlighted. Other legal issues that you should be aware of is the legislation. Henkilötietolaki, dating back to the 1990s, it's still in place in Finland. It will be replaced by the new law, Finnish law, which complements the GDPR at the national level. So that's probably going to happen in September. There's already a proposal out there by the government.
They should vote today, but I'm not sure about
right, that. Right, okay, yes. But, you know, keep your eyes peeled. It's coming, and very soon. And it's going to give additional information and additional specifications in addition to GDPR in terms of research ethics as well. Not only relevant to social media research, of course, but to all research. And then terms and conditions we talked about already. Another issue, you need to be aware of to put it very simply, the ethicality of the tools that you use in social media research, the methodologies and the instruments that are often quite lucrative in terms of, you know, doing, collecting, archiving, processing social media data. But they might actually, these tools have social ethical research ethical implications as well. And if you're supervising student work, I mean, this is particularly an important issue to remind students that, okay, all those publicly available tools, may not that be the best possible solution in terms of research ethics or right, public and private, the issue of public and private data, and I already said there's a whole lot of debate in this area. But again, the rule of thumb here is that whether a post should be perceived as public or private largely depends on the online context itself, and the participants, the social media users' perception of whether their posts are public or not.
Doesn't this run against the previous principle that the small print must be consulted? So isn't the company providing the content the one to decide, or can you ignore it here? So if you think that it's very public, everybody can see it, there is nothing that would make it private, but the company says that it denies any research on these materials. So is this nonsensical? If it's technically decided by the content provider or the web admin, so how do these two points meet?
Well, I would say in that case, I mean, it's the company small print which rules over this, right? If they categorically deny the extraction of data from their website in any form and its reuse, then that overrules whatever the social media users themselves think of as public or private.
So the power is given to the companies who provide
in this
content.
Case, yes. Yes. It's a legal issue at that stage. I mean, the terms and conditions are legal discourse.
So somebody can stop all research if there is.
Yes. Yes, go ahead, sorry.
Well, this is... I don't want to all the time argue it. It's a yes and no question, but also as a user, when you go and you register, you either agree or don't agree, and that's one stepping stone further. And so common sense is also very good. And how would you perceive, would you like that your Facebook posts would be used for anyone with or without consent? So that's something that we all need to consider, that are we allowing this to be done to our children or to us? And it's a one good starting point anyway. And nothing more I have.
Does this all concern only the identification, the identifiable material, or does it concern all material? Because if it concerns only the right of people to be identified, or if it concerns, for instance, the company's other materials, then I would say I wouldn't agree. But if it concerns only what Sari said only things about whether there are identifiable people, so about the right to be identified, or does it concern the whole set? I can say a concrete example from my previous research. I have done linguistic landscape research, and for instance, Tesco has these no photography signs all over the place. So no linguistic landscape research on Tesco is possible.
Mm-hmm.
And if, let's say, Tesco would have on its all social media stuff no research sign, there will be such sign, I guess, in the future, then would any social media research on Tesco be possible? Or is it just that that research would be impossible, which includes some identifiable persons? So who does this law actually protect? Does it protect the companies, or does it protect the persons identifiable?
Are you talking now about the GDPR, or yes, which law?
The GDPR. So right. The GDPR, could it give Tesco the right to deny all access to its content on social media, or just the identifiable?
You have to remember that the GDPR, it is about the rights of the individual subjects, the human beings. And then the terms and conditions of companies are about the rights of the companies. So,
the is it only the small print about the human rights of the human beings that is important?
Right. Yes. Have you talked about the local ethical committee work? I mean, Sari is a member. I used to be the chair of that committee for some years. So just as a reminder, what to do in cases where the data you collect and investigate may potentially cause some harm or risk to the subjects that you're investigating. And in this case, if there's a risk of harm, social, physical, psychological, you need to seek for the ethical approval from the local ethics committee. And these are the cases which you need to bear in mind then. So if there's a risk, and if you're not seeking informed consent in your study, remembering the fact that you don't need an ethical assessment by the committee if you're doing research on public or published information, register or document data. And then you need one more thing. When you're investigating children under 15, 16, under the Finnish law, right? And children under 16.
Interpretation of the GDPR.
Right, yes. I mean, they may not be in completely in line.
It can be from 13 to 16, and Finland have chosen
16. Right. If you're investigating children under 16 and you don't have parental consent to collect the data, in these cases, you need to seek for ethical approval by the committee, right? This is the situation as it is now. It may change to some extent when GDPR becomes interpreted in detail at this university as well. Do you have any information about that, Sari? No?
We are literally now in between two legislations, and we will update the information, the informed consent forms and everything according to the new legislation. So by August, everything should be right. Mm-hmm. And now all universities are negotiating what kind of a platform would it be that people would have enough information, not too much information, mm-hmm. about their possibilities or willingness to join, participate in research, and what types of data there will be about collected about them. So otherwise, and there's yet another thing that quite a few publications, journals or publishing houses now require an ethical decision some sort of a decision from ethical committees, even though there wouldn't be any problems. So there's a shortcut form for in our committee site.
Right.
One question from Kazakhstan. Mm-hmm. If someone reposts the information from a private account on Instagram/Facebook, and the owner doesn't specifically give consent, can we consider it as a right violation to use it for research?
Right, that's a good question. Marina, you've been thinking about exactly the same thing. Can you answer this question? I mean, Marina is looking at Instagram data, and she's also has had to think about the secondary comments to her subject's posts. I think it's analogous to the comments to your subject's posts, yeah, from whom you don't have consent.
Yeah, but I think that she or he is talking about reposting, and I don't know if they are followers' comments, followers' comments.
Yeah, so like I share, let's say somebody had posted something, and then I share it onto mine, and then somebody extracts it from mine. Is that a violation? Because the person who originally posted it didn't give consent necessarily, right?
But I think that the platforms, mm-hmm. allow participants to do that, at least on Twitter. But on Facebook, I think that you can also share what others post. Okay. So I don't know.
That actually makes sense. If you have because they're. Mm.
Yeah, and the posters may be aware of the fact that their posts will be read by a whole lot of other people. So that, in a way, there's awareness of the public out there. Yes.
Yeah, because when you join the Instagram, you need to be able to understand that somebody can repost it's part of the features in the platform. So basically, there's no violation because it's likes and something you can do on other platforms.
Right. Yes, indeed.
You're allowed to share.
Yes.
Yes.
Right. Exactly. If it's a public post, a public account, yes, indeed. All right, thank you. I should give the floor to Samu now, two points before I wrap up. Right, seeking of consent. Besides the issues that the local ethical committee already stipulates as those that you should follow in terms of seeking their ethical approval, you should think about whether or not it's necessary for you to seek consent, how sensitive the topic is. Is the exposure of the subjects through sharing their data publicly somehow harmful for them, or are they vulnerable in some way? Right. Okay. I think I'm going to stop.
Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you, Sipa.
Samu, the floor is yours.
Joo. Joo. Niinpä. Se kuitenkin on niinku tutkija. Mitä? Niin, niin, just. Joo.
Oh.
Sorry, I thought you had something.
Yeah. Here, go on.
Okay.
Sorry.
It's on. It's not on mute. Yes. And the right place, maybe here. Okay. Hello again. My name is Samu Kytölä. I'm from this department, the Language and Communication Studies Department, University of Jyväskylä, senior lecturer at the moment, and I've been that for 3 years. So I've been mainly in teaching lately, but I'm also, my other ego is also a postdoc researcher. First of all, I want to thank you, Neti and Sigurd, for inviting me and considering me an expert on the topic. When I replied yes, with a caveat that I don't have so much to say about the EU and the GDPR. But luckily, we have had Sirpa as well. Basically, all my spring has been spent on teaching, marking, and supervision. So what I'm going to be talking is mainly stuff I did a few years ago and reflections on how that affects, research ethics I followed and continue to follow before in my research. Okay, I'm very happy that Sirpa was the first speaker because you already had taken the time and effort to find out about things. Actually, we had a small seminar together a week ago or so about the EU GDPR things. And you actually, towards the end of your talk, you covered a lot of stuff quickly that I was planning to mention here, so very happy to have a kind of a bridge there. You actually miraculously touched upon a few issues I'd been scribbling here myself. So very quickly, research ethics, I'm going to outline a few things here in my first slides, and then we'll have a look at a couple of data examples from my research some years ago concerning web forums and such. Okay. Excuse me a second. I have to remove this chair. Yes. So some of the issues I've been thinking about in the past 13 years or so regarding research ethics on social media are listed here. First of all, is the stuff we as sociolinguists, we as discourse analysts, we as ethnographers, we as ethnographers or online ethnographers and so on. Coming back to this here. Is it discourse or is it interaction? Is it study of texts or multimodal texts? Or is it study of people? do we follow the idea of the internet as artifact or the internet as relationships between people? These are very old issues. These have been discussed already in the 90s in the CMC research. Then another important issue, which Sirpa already covered to some extent, is anonymity of online actors, anonymity, protecting anonymity of people writing stuff online, people posting and publishing stuff online, versus giving the same people or different people online credit for their work. So this is a clash I see in my work. This is a clash I see in a lot of work. And I'm very unhappy with the ways in which, in the name of protection and anonymity, which are very important, I agree, we actually erase a lot of credit in our work. Which leads us to artistic rights. To what extent is publishing and posting on the internet in different social media art or original contribution? Copyrights, and so on. Then we should pay attention to technicalities of different formats. Who can access them online and how? What prerequisites does it take to access which kind of data? And I think a lot of the ethical decision and decisions and ethical discussion around researching social media has been too much stuck on technicalities. So regarding stuff that is out there publicly as public and stuff that is hidden somewhere there, which is behind a registration or behind gatekeeping, private. And the line is not so clear. The researcher should be much more open to a spectrum of open publicness and privateness in online data. Then, of course, as Sirpa pointed out, sensitivity of vulnerability. This comes out very often in online research. And very often the sources we use, even we as sociolinguists, we as discourse analysts, the sources we use, the references we use come from the study of medical subjects, okay, so illnesses, medical research, which is on the one hand very far from what we do, on the other hand it can be pretty close to what we do. We're talking about people's stories about being who they are, whether ill or well. And this all boils down to researchers' position. It's very important, as Sirpa pointed out, to think very, very carefully about your position as a researcher. Who are you in relation to the informants? Who are you in relation to the text you study? Are you an insider? Are you an outsider? And so on. Okay. And then the something I'm going to talk about much less and not much at all, because Sirpa covered it and because I told this to Neti when I said yes. Let's keep that for another discussion. Or we can reflect on the jurisdiction legislation stuff after I've given my talk. It's just the wrong computer, sorry. Okay, and this is just a brief list of some of the formats I've been studying in my humble and short researcher career, about 13 years. Web discussion forums, blogs and blogs comment sections, newspaper, etc. comment sections, online media comment sections, Twitter, celebrities and other public accounts, also personal interchange on Twitter, very personal issues, which is there publicly displayed. Facebook to some extent, but a little bit less. It's quite difficult, as we know now. And I haven't been too keen again. I might be there someday with Facebook, but I haven't really published research on Facebook so much at all. Others collected, not used in publications so far. And also, as I pointed out in my comment to Sirpa's talk, we are also teaching and supervising theses at the same time. This has been my main work for the past 3 years, so I've been much more focused on teaching my students about the issues than thinking about them in terms of my own research. Many of us are interested in ethnography of some kind, ethnographic approach to digital discourse, if you like. According to this approach, all texts are traces, products of human interaction and human relationships, stemming from quite often from a kind of a community, some kind of a community. But Very often, discourse analytic sociolinguistic study of, even if it's ethnographically framed or ethnographically inclined, the focus is on the language, the focus is on the discourse, the ways of speaking, the ways of writing, styles, lexical choices, and so on. To the extent that the individuals behind the text sometimes get blurred. And I would say a major part of my research, more than 50% of my research so far, has been with this kind of approach. Not so much focus on the individuals behind the text. But to what extent can these be kept separate? Some of us would argue not at all. There's no discourse without people producing the discourse, and so on. Public versus private, text versus interaction. Mind you, I'm not going to say that public equals text and private equals interaction. These are two axes. I didn't have the time to prepare a fancy PowerPoint with coordinates X and Y axis, and some of my reflections would quite nicely fit that kind of a two-dimensional XY axis presentation. One extreme or one stance claims that all the possible caveats and ethical guidelines we know from any human research should also be applied to studies on humans' interaction online. That sounds feasible. This makes a great sense. True, especially when it's about humans. Versus the more distant, more objective discourse, text, language analysts' point of view, any texts publicly accessible on the web are readily available for research use, since their producers are, or were, or at least they should have been, or they should be, aware that what you post online, what you publish online, stays online. Even when you remove it afterwards, it might be there. And I think we're getting in the gray area here because of, for example, this. But I think still, as Sirpa pointed out, we have to use our own judgment. I think also Sari pointed out we have to use common sense. I think this is still a safe assumption for most data accessible online, regardless of the format, regardless of whether it's text or pictures or videos. I think I'm not saying that the end justifies means and we could do anything to achieve the research ends, but I would say that this is a safe assumption for most things we do, especially when we keep in mind the researcher's position and the possible vulnerability and sensibility. Then access to data. We are facing a whole range of different kinds of data online, from completely openly accessible online texts, and this is also relative. Something which is completely accessible in point one can be completely inaccessible in another point in time. So it could happen just once. It can be ephemeral and so on. Forever, I put in quotation marks. Nothing is forever. And then to formats and texts that require registration, gate passing, in order to access. Typically, you have to be a registered member of a service or a forum to get access to that kind of data. And then another question is, even if you have the technical access to a lot of different data, either completely open or via gatekeeping, who is the data meant for? Certainly not primarily the researcher. It's meant for people to do their stuff and not for us to research their stuff. And some people go to extremes, claiming that it's not meant for research, so don't research. I would disagree quite strongly, but I would keep this in mind. The anonymity versus credit thing has been bothering me for years, as I said. Most of the time, I see Bruckman's Light Disguise 2002 approach applicable to stuff I do. It might not be applicable to stuff you do. As Sirpa pointed out, changing names, changing even pseudonyms, and changing all other identifying details. Not changing verbatim quotes. So verbatim quotes may be used, especially when we're doing linguistic discourse analytic stuff. It's quite important for us to know exactly what is said in which ways. So the actual grammar, the actual structure, the actual juxtaposition of text and picture without distorting or without blurring anything. However, point 2b, even if they could be used to identify an individual, becomes questionable, especially now with the new EU legislation. And this is, again, not yes or no, it's a grey area, I think. Group members, the insiders themselves, may be able to guess who is being discussed. This is very much the case in my research on the football forums in Finland. There's a limited number of football forums in Finland. Actually, there was only one major forum at the time. A limited number of hardcore members, okay, maybe 10,000 registered members, but only 100, 150 people who are very, very active. So when I'm talking anonymously about somebody discussing a particular club, a particular match, a particular football cultural phenomenon, intelligent group members with a little bit of Sherlock Holmes mind will know who I'm talking about. Okay, but an outsider who gets into the issue could probably figure out who is who, especially the pseudonym relationships, if not the real life equivalents, with little investigation. This is sort of what the researcher does, actually. And then details that are harmful to individuals should be omitted.
One question on this. Just your data of yours, because I have been on other forums, irrelevant here, but there it seems that now people no longer can use nicknames in forums. Has that happened in football forums as well, and what does it change if so?
So, did you say that there are forums in which pseudonyms were the norm before, but now people are obliged to use their real names?
Yeah, according they are kind of following the GDPR, and they say that no longer are nicknames allowed because of that.
I never thought that would...
No, they need to register with their real name, but they can use nicknames.
And some forums have interpreted such way that you also have to use. But I don't know about the football forums. What has happened there?
First of all, I don't follow all the football forums at the moment very closely. I do keep an eye on Footis Forum 2, which is the biggest one, and certainly there's been no change there. But I don't think the EU GDPR legislation requires any kind of social medium to convert their people from nicknames into real names. That's the policy by Facebook to begin with, and even Facebook is flexible, so you can actually use a nickname, which is what I'm doing currently on Facebook, so that people who know me can find me, but people can't find me with my exact real name. But I think it's up to the administration of different forums and different groups and services whether they allow or require pseudonyms or not. So I don't think that's...
But I mean, a forum which requires to reveal your identity is unresearchable or not. That's my final question.
We can discuss that. I don't have the answer. It's too... I would need much more time to think about it. Probably, depending on the sensitivity or vulnerability of the topics and the openness of the actual forum to public without registration, my first guess would be to use the text, use the forum, observe it, but change the real names into pseudonyms that the researcher comes up with. Or, if it's a small community especially, you can be in contact with the community as a researcher openly, which is what I would favor now, or at least with the admins or the moderators, and then find out about ways in which the researcher... researchees, the targets of research would like themselves to be represented. So they might want to say, use my name, but that's quite difficult to do now. So, and it's not a clear-cut distinction between public figures and totally unknown figures. You can be a semi-celebrity, known in certain circles, but certainly not known in the whole country of Finland, for example.
But in that case, a simple Google research would find the real names instantly. So it's only just 1 second. You just put the text there and then it shows. Because the
It depends. It depends. As Margareta pointed out to me, in private search engines don't find everything anymore. Search engines don't find everything that's online anymore because maybe you can explain it later, Margareta, if you're an expert. Yeah.
In between immersed data, so like it's not quite accurate that if you Google something, it will show it to you.
Yeah. Okay. And my final point is about the researcher's position. This is very important, I think, and something you need to think about in the beginning, the early parts of your study, when you're planning your study, when you're contacting the informants, if you're contacting them at all, depends on whether you're the discourse text kind of guy or the ethnographer kind of guy. So, are you a complete outsider or a complete insider or something in between? Very often, I think the researcher is something in between. They're interested in the topic, they have invested in the topic in their free time maybe or in their professional life, but they are not part of the exact community they're researching. That's quite often the case. That was certainly the case with me in my Footis Forum research. I was really a part of the footballing community locally and later to some extent even in Finland. But I definitely wasn't part of the discussions before I started the research. So researchers have to carefully outline and acknowledge their interests and stances vis-a-vis the researched online communities. Moreover, not only that, but there are always the ubiquitous factors which I think influence all human research done by us on humans or human communities. The researcher's ethnicity, nationality, gender, age, and so on, sexual orientation, and so on. We always look at things from our perspective that way. So that's also, I think, it's important to attach this kind of intersectional approach to the more case-specific consideration of who are you in relation to the community. I have a few examples from my earlier research. Now, this is the theory part is here, but shall I show maybe two or three before we have a final discussion?
Yes, I think that would be nice.
Yes, okay. Mind you, these might come even from the 1990s, so these represent some of the old social media, which I think is useful because I'm always been interested in the history of the social media, not only the current hot media. Okay, so here's an example from my work, different formats and different ethical solutions. I did use topic lists from the different evolutionary stages of football forums in Finland. I used them as screenshots, I used them as raw material. They can't be found anymore apart from the Internet Archive Wayback Machine. The archive tool which can uncover some of the old versions, not anymore, but it used to be the case with this Footis Forum. So I didn't do any further anonymization, even if there was Johanna or Jussi Hanska in this. I think these are very generic. The focus is not on who is Jussi Hanska, who is Johanna, or who is Kei Hietala. Probably this would be not allowed today anymore. And the same goes for later stages of Footis Forum. It looks very 90s. It's actually 2001, January. Okay, you have Janne, you have Timo. But I think this is somewhere in the borderline. If I needed to, I would be happy to do this kind of research from a researcher's ethical point of view. But I wonder if the new legislation makes us prevents us from... Is this already a list of persons? Because, as I will show you later, pseudonyms count as personal data in the actual legislation.
Are those closed forums
Depends. It depends. Let me show you. I used snapshots a lot. Some of them I used without obscuring the pseudonyms or without changing them. I think they are pretty generic. I think they are pretty representative of the real thing. I think they should be there. others, especially in my Routledge, Elsevier, Paul Graham Macmillan publications, I changed or blurred. Because, you know, you had the US or UK legislation at the time, let's say 2008 or 2012, to cope with. So I chose the safe path and anonymized the pseudonyms. Okay? Here are some of the screenshots I use to illustrate the member lists and what information they give out about themselves. This would be totally forbidden now, I think. This is from my dissertation, so it was there six years ago. Published, yes. You have the nicknames, you have their self-appointed locations, which are very often cities in Finland. I think this would be impossible to publish now. It's like a register of real persons, and I didn't change the pseudonyms because the idea of this mini study was actually to study the pseudonyms and what information they give out about themselves. That was the exact topic. Yeah. Then again, this is completely open information. Anybody can still go and see this. Yes.
So then it's not so bad that you have to...
It's still a register of persons because pseudonyms count as personal data. And it's a register with their join date, their self-appointed location, their number of posts. Mm. I think this is... I'm not too keen on repeating this study, I mean, but I think it's a bit sad that this kind of overall... Oh, you could do this kind of overall study, but only by paraphrase. You can't use the hard evidence in your publications or maybe not even your seminar presentations anymore.
Are you saying that the field of the study of pseudonyms is over? You were one of the last researchers to do a study on pseudonyms, since now it's...
Okay, so in 100 years it will be the landmark. Everybody will appreciate and quote my 2013 pseudonym research.
Last study.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Then later, postdoc, Elina Westinen and I did a study on, a very interesting study on authenticity and normativity of celebrity footballers. Okay, Finnish footballers, but they are or were celebrities. On Twitter, and how these Twitter discussions are echoed and recontextualized in the footies forums and other social media of the time. Actually, the stuff we used was from 2010, but we wrote it 2013 and got it published 2015. So it's always the material you publish about is always 3 or 4 years old, if it's a journal or a high-profile Routledge or something book. Okay, you can... probably publish a working paper on something very recent very quickly. Okay, so we just used public Twitter accounts of celebrities the way they are. And Twitter luckily has the nice small print in contrast to Twitch, right? And this is an illustration of how we used it in the actual article. So we used some of the screenshots from Twitter, we used some of the screenshots from Footies Forum, blurring the pseudonyms or changing them, and then we use the celebrities' tweets between themselves publicly as such. I think this is fair to say it's public discourse. And finally, my last example is on something we had to omit from our article together with Sirpa, for reasons of space and reasons of copyright / artistic rights. So I was keen on including a small cartoon strip by a Finnish football forumist who was very active in doing these kinds of very amateurish four square cartoons about current football topics, and these were very popular among the community and a very interesting foci for research because of their multimodality and recontextualization and textualization, resemiotization. And I thought, well, I think this is already artistic. This is something that deserves a copyright. So before we sent the final version, I contacted the nickname, but I got no answer. And even 4 years later, that nickname hasn't answered. And he or she, I think it's he hasn't even logged on into the forum anymore. So he's out. And you can never reach him again. And we decided to omit it for reasons of space anyway. But it would be very interesting to not only research this, but also show this in your publication or in your seminar presentation. I'm here. Please sue me if you want. For showing this, because it's immensely interesting from empirical and theoretical point of view on illustrating how texts and multimodal creations circulate on the internet. This is my final point. So just for discussion, I have a few questions about the pseudonyms versus personal data. How do we deal with the new online participation formats which keep on sprouting all the time, and the convergence and divergence of formats between each other, and then the ethnographically inclined research we're doing, many of us are doing, zooming in and out between discourse and humans. That's where I stop. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Samu.
Do you have any final questions?
Yes, not much time left, but maybe you decide, Sigurd and Nettie.
If you've got.
I've got a little bit of time, but not forever.
Mine is not a question, but rather a comment. It comes with the ethnographic research, and quite often ethnographic research is both offline and online. And it's also good to, for anyone to remember, you mentioned that especially in online settings, people are not doing things for the sake of research. And this is exactly when, if researchers have become good friends or in good terms offline, and then they turn into relationship online, so it's really difficult, and it's one of the questions that we have come across lately is that what are the researchers' own online practices and activities, and are they, when they think they are doing them by that they are, don't think that they are researchers and they are still in touch with the people who are their research participants, are they actually revealing their people's anonymities? So are they protecting, and who's in anonymity they are protecting. So yes. These are questions that come all the time, and they are really the one of that belong. Yeah. I feel that they belong into the gray area.
Yes, and this is very tricky. I don't have the answer, of course, but I'm very happy that you raised this question, sorry, because the legislation on the one hand, and then all the copyright issues and such, they come from, they are often either or. They are 100 or zero, yeah. One or zero. And they don't really apply as such to much of the research we do as ethnographers or discourse analysts. We are in the gray area between 0 and 100. And, you know, medical research, this is clearly the objective medical researcher, the doctor, the physician in their white jacket doing research on something, somebody who's not their friend. But we are maybe sometimes engaging with, let's say, let's say immigrants in Finland, and who might become, if not friends, at least a bit closer to us in the process than just research targets. And I think that's actually for the benefit of research. You do better research if you know your targets that way better and understand them better. It's very different. And I think all the legislation and copyright issues are too black and white for us to follow. We have to pay much more attention to our own judgment and the real ethical issues.
Yes, I agree completely. And then you have to also remember that ethnography is also about becoming very knowledgeable and gaining the insider view of whatever you're investigating. So it means some much more intimate engagement with what you're researching than, you know, in the positivistic
and from the ethical point of view, that causes quite a lot of need for reasoning and reflection on
perhaps this
our
could
position.
Be one topic for
yeah,
some other sessions.
Yeah, I really
so.
Think.
I think you got. There's so much information, and some of the people from Kazakhstan they have many more questions. I think this topic would be a very interesting thing to not argue about, but discuss. If you come along, we'll be arguing about it. But to have a further discussion later on in the fall, if you wouldn't mind, joining again.
Thank you. If I may add just one general comment, we've been looking at these social media practices and how we do ethnographic research on them. You know, I think on the other hand, it would be useful as well just look at the comments we now had and then look at re-examine our established ethnographic practices from this new sensitivity, this what you mentioned about interaction versus text. I mean, and re-examine our established practices from. So again, there is much more to this and much more to be said about this. And we will come back to this in later forums, definitely. Okay, any other comments?
Thank you, guys.
Okay, then, yeah. Thank you, Samu, Sirpa, all you present, and also our remote audience. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You're welcome. Yeah.